This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston hit 100 degrees yesterday.
That heat emergency here in Boston now going through Monday. And let me tell you, it is too hot not to get into some
spend cool any time at all outside today. You know how hot it is out
Amen.
There.
That's yeah, the heat advisory bad. Where it's feeling like over 100 degrees deeper into this afternoon.
That sound from WCVB and NBC 10. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has extended the city's heat emergency through today. And that is just one major piece of city business in this fast-paced summer. Well, fortunately, we were on the agenda for today and here in Studio 2 to talk about the heat wave and so much more. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, who's back for Mondays with the Mayor. Welcome to the studio.
Always great to be here. Thanks for giving me some AC.
Yeah, you are not wilting, right? It feels like the whole world is wilting right now.
You know, this is our seventh day of heat emergency here in Boston. And unfortunately, it's a little taste of where we are headed with our changing climate. Boston has been projected for some time now to have a steadily increasing number of days over 90 degrees as part of our summer. It's going to grow and grow. And so we're at the point of urgency to really dig in on tackling the climate crisis and also find ways to mitigate and adapt right now.
So let's start kind of personal with that. I mean, you've got munchkins. What did you guys do this weekend to beat the heat? And were your kids going stir crazy or were they the sort of outdoors in the slip and slide kind of kids?
Yeah, there was a little slip and slide yesterday. The day before on Saturday, we went out to check out the Revere Sandcastle Festival. But even then, right, without trees, it was fun. And there were all sorts of giveaways of you know, Yasa was there handing out popsicles and this and that, but everybody had their big hat on and we couldn't stay there for too long because it was way too hot.
So you're taking the business of this heat very seriously in terms of the larger climate plan, heat mitigation plans, et cetera.
The best technology we have to fight the climate crisis is green infrastructure, trees and open space. And so that continues to be a priority of how we're building and envisioning the city. At the same time, it's too far into the future to wait until all of our new trees and forest and canopy is built. And so there are measures already of air conditioning units being installed in all of the school buildings just because the time frame during the school year is already a hotter period than it had been in the past. Cooling centers that are now in expanded locations and cooling kits that are out in the community. So even if you don't want to physically go to an indoor center, you can a neighborhood group can come and rent or borrow a cooling kit that includes sprinklers for the kids and just to really deploy all the water features we have all across the city.
So I'm going to stay on this for just one more second because then we have a ton more to do. But you talked about the green canopy and growing trees. I'm sure you're aware of the reporting in the Boston Globe over the weekend where they talked about the heat island in Chinatown.
That's right.
How hard it is with lack of trees there. It's one of the most tree barren neighborhoods. And how does one, I mean, if you walking through Chinatown, what do you move? What do you change in order to make space for the level of trees that would be necessary to mitigate that? And how much of a priority is that?
This has measurable consequences for people's health, for the ability to be outdoors as a worker who might have a job that is focused on doing work outside, or as a senior or young person or someone with medical conditions. And so we've measured in the past that there's a 10 degree difference across the city depending on the tree cover. It makes a huge, huge difference. In Chinatown, there's a group that has already identified, one of our community partners, Speak for the Trees, has already gone through and measured every single tree that is there, as well as the empty tree pits that are just calling out for new
just
trees
waiting
to be planted. So there is some low-hanging fruit, if you will, about how we can immediately get trees into the ground. Now, we have to be very intentional about how this happens. The city needs to staff up on arborists and the maintenance because we have found that in recent years, even as Boston has been planting more trees, they're not surviving in those crucial few months after they're immediately planted. And so having clear community partnerships to water, maintain, doing it at the right time of year, if you put a tree in the ground right now, it would not survive. And
no.
So timing all of that right and continuing to build on our efforts.
So I'm going to pivot. You mentioned workers outdoors, and you were just outdoors with some workers about an hour and a half ago. You stopped by at the strike that's happening down the street on Commonwealth Avenue in Brookline in front of Starbucks. Here's a little sound of you, actually.
We are going to make sure that Boston continues to lead the way in fighting for safe working conditions, in the benefits and wages and respect that you all deserve.
Last week, as the strike began, we spoke with Spencer Costigan, who's a shift manager at the 874 ComAv store. Here's a little bit of what they had to say.
We all decided, hey, we'd like to unionize so we could try to improve these conditions. Maybe we could get some more pay. Maybe we could get some better hour guarantees. Maybe we could get some better health care coverage.
So, you know, 100 degrees, 98 degrees, pay, health care coverage. Is this what it takes? What can you do if this is what you want to see changed, which you just said, so that this isn't what it takes?
These are our essential workers. And even though we are a little bit removed from the drastic shutdowns during the pandemic, those same lessons and that same urgency to care for our frontline workers should still apply in every situation. And here we have a case where workers voted to unionize and were met with stiff resistance, including some alleged union busting and retaliation that was happening. And so we're standing in solidarity with these workers. They are asking to have recognition of their union and to have the negotiations and contract that they deserve. And so I'll continue to stand with unionization efforts across the city. We've seen Boston really leading the way in some of the new industries that are offering protections now through unionization to workers, such as at Pavement Coffee.
So it's a big sign when you show up in front of a store where people are striking. You've been very clear about your support for unions and unionization. As the mayor of the city, you also have to support the businesses of the city. And while it's not always the case, it is certainly often the case that unions and the business owners are adversarial. So do you worry when you show up someplace like in front of Starbucks today that that makes it more difficult to do the collaboration you need to do with businesses tomorrow?
I hope it sends a message that that collaboration is urgent and, in fact, that we have to reject old, tired ways of framing the conversation, that it's either about protecting workers or having a successful business. In fact, what we saw during the pandemic and what continues to be reinforced is that to be a successful business, you have to take care of your workers. And in fact, that then feeds right back into the productivity, the public goodwill, and the support that you'll be able to have as an entity and neighbor in our city.
Is there a business and a workforce in the city of Boston that you see today that gets the framing right between them and has the kind of productive relationship you're looking for?
I think many of our workplaces are working hand in hand with workers, and we're doing our best as a city to try to live that mold as well. I came into office a little over 8 months ago, and every single one of our collective bargaining agreements across more than 30 unions that are municipal unions were expired. And so we've been really focusing on getting those done one by one. Some of our largest unions have now come under agreement or contract with the city, including most recently the Boston Teachers Union. And so I can't ever go out there and preach what we're not willing to do ourselves. And so we're trying to model that as a city as well.
We'll come back later to the teachers union and the negotiation there. So just one more time, any specific examples, things you'd hold up in the city?
Pavement Coffee is right in the same industry, and an example where the union, the workers voted to unionize, began organizing, and then the company voluntarily recognized them. And I still try to stop by there whenever I can to support that great union. For me, I don't drink coffee, so matcha lattes. But it is something that feeds into supporting both the workers and the business.
So I said to you before the show started that I don't know that I've seen a month before where there were so many different news topics. So I want to shift because there's other breaking news just this morning. News on the city's attempts to rebuild the Long Island Bridge in order to reopen a shuttered addiction recovery and shelter facility there that was closed in 2014 due to bridge conditions. Quincy has resisted, essentially arguing the attempt violates a local ordinance. The Supreme Judicial Court just this morning upheld a superior court ruling from late 2020 that basically denies Quincy the ability to hold it up based on that, upholds the superior court ruling. Your reactions on that news?
It's, I think in some ways we were hoping and expecting that Boston would be able to have the authority to have full flexibility in choosing how we can access the land that is the city of Boston's out on Long Island. I've had some great conversations with the mayor of Quincy, and we met in City Hall a number of months ago to really understand how we could be partners in this work instead of adversaries. This is a regional challenge that Boston is taking on right now. So many of the individuals who are seeking treatment and support and services, who are struggling with substance use and mental health and lacking housing. In fact, when we survey residents there, more than 80% of folks say that they are coming from the last zip code of residents outside the city of Boston. And so we know that we are a central city that is providing the services and as that safety net, we need support from the state and from regional partners, and we'll look to do this as collaboratively as possible.
So the pressure is on in the area of Milnia Cass Boulevard and Massachusetts Avenue, especially around the Roundhouse Hotel and concentrated services there. You were part of the effort to remove tents and provide other supports at the beginning of the year. I remember back last fall during the debates, you being very clear that Long Island Bridge was a piece, right, but not the only piece. And yet I wonder, of course, sooner or later, the Supreme Judicial Court ruling was coming. So what happens tomorrow? Are there shovels ready? Do you go? Does the bridge become a core piece of the strategy now?
We're still a little ways away from, let me put it this way. We need to first decide and set what the plan is for services that will be offered on the island before rushing into the best mechanisms of formalizing the transportation to the island. Now, we had a situation previously where there were shelter beds on the island, there were recovery services, there was many of the beds in the largest number of beds in the region were at on Long Island. Many of those beds have since been relocated to the area near Mass and Cass, and so there's a lot of coordination and ripple effects that would happen. So I think we need to first set what exactly the island will be used for. There are also indigenous communities that have alerted us to the needs and sacred sites on the island. And so having planning that is done very carefully in coordination about potential development or building. I've gone out with the team and surveyed the buildings that are in pretty rough shape after 7 years of sitting vacant and having the weather and rain penetrate or sometimes animals in there. And so there's a lot of work that would have to be done both on the island as well as transportation.
Do you have a time frame for that planning?
Our focus right now is to maintain where we are with Mass and Cass. It is a, just to set expectations, it is a different set of issues during the summer than in the winter. And our hope is to head into this fall in a different place than we did last fall, which is with nearly 300 tents, really risking a lot in terms of lives and safety in the area. And so every single day we continue to take down tents so that that area is clear and we will not have fortified encampments. And we're looking to decentralize services too, hoping that Shattuck Hospital will be one key piece of that, that RFP is now available, that the state has released, and that we could potentially relocate or connect the services currently being offered at the Roundhouse to a campus that is set up like that, for example, at the Shattuck, and then put Long Island in as a longer-term piece along with those existing services.
We're talking to Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here on Mondays with the Mayor on Radio Boston. Shifting gears now, when you started, was white supremacy on your radar screen as something you were going to need to handle in your mayoral agenda?
It's been a whirlwind of issues at the national level, and the handling of them or lack thereof spilling over into what local communities have to deal with. And so when I first started, almost immediately it was the Omicron surge, which undoubtedly was tied to federal policies and the need for more leadership stemming from local communities. And I think similarly, we have a...
Are you saying the surge itself was tied to federal policy?
I'm saying that the need for communities to step in as much as we had to with local policies such as vaccination requirements or requirements for policies to protect those entering businesses, that fell entirely on local communities to address and weigh and implement. And similarly, we see a surge nationally of white supremacy and hate and the efforts to target what amount to domestic terrorism still are falling on the shoulders of states and municipalities. And so we're in close coordination. I'm grateful that here in Massachusetts, there's alignment across the board in terms of law enforcement agencies and elected officials to say, we are going to root this out of our community. Now, the recent incidents and displays have come from outside Boston and outside our community. And we become a target because Boston is such a clear and vibrant example of progressive leadership, of diversity in our community leadership, in policies that we're implementing, and we will continue to be prepared.
So let me jump in for listeners. The recent displays, of course, much was made of the Patriot Front march over the 4th of July weekend. Estimates are around 100 marchers masked wearing similar clothing. We then had another march, maybe it's not a march, maybe a standout, whatever you want to call it, over the weekend with a neo-Nazi group that has appeared in the city before, this time outside the historic Loring Greeno House where residents were gathered for a children's drag queen story hour. And the messaging on this weekend was explicitly anti-LGBTQ messaging. We have covered here the graffiti that went around the Pride development in Hyde Park. Also, strong anti-LGBTQ language. A, do you have any intelligence that those two things were related, that it was the same group that did the Pride as was showing up this weekend? Do you know?
We do not have that intelligence.
Okay. Yeah. And what kind of intelligence are you asking for from sort of your command center in the city now as we, this is twice in a month. So what are you asking for and what are you now monitoring and tracking?
Again, it requires a lot of coordination because Boston's law enforcement, Boston police and our public safety agencies are responsible and we are prepared as soon as these groups set foot in our city, but they are coming from outside the city, whether it is the leader of this group over the weekend who was arrested at that demonstration and hails from Pepperell, Massachusetts, and many of the groups from across the region and outside our city, or the other group whose leaders came from out of state in here. And so we rely on our federal partners to provide that information to us to the extent that they are monitoring and watching for these behaviors and the connection to Boston. But we need more from them as well. We need to have a greater focus nationally on how these groups can be tracked and monitored and categorized as verging on domestic terrorism. Now, the First Amendment protects hateful speech, right? That is part of the basics of our country, but it does not protect anything close to threats, violence, or attacks on our residents. And we are working as a city to find ways to best prepare and respond when these efforts to intimidate us are happening. But the reality is that as Boston continues to lead, as we continue to be an example nationally for what it looks like for empowered community leadership and partnership with diversity across our city, state, and national representation, we will continue to be a target. And we're working closely with community groups to try to educate and empower our residents as well.
Okay, and just really briefly before a break, U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Rachel Rollins has said she's planning to launch a hotline to report white supremacist activity. Just quickly, your reaction to that.
Yeah, it's been great. She has been an incredible leader and partner on this, and so we're collaborating on ensuring that we will get that information in real time. Of course, it'll be plugged into the federal efforts with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, but as well as the local enforcement agencies and our Boston Police.
So I'm going to play a little sound for you here. Seemingly random, but do you recognize it?
That song's been played at a lot of different places, including our inauguration party.
That's it, right there. Your inauguration when you almost started to groove a little bit there. It was quite a party, and it was a different feeling.
It was wonderful.
And mayoralship is serious business, and you demonstrate it quite seriously. You looked like you had a ball, literally a ball.
We had weighed whether or not to even have an inauguration because the original plans back in January were postponed because of the surge, the Omicron surge, and then it was, pretty far past inauguration at that point. But we decided with the end of the school year, with so much that communities have been going through, to do it a little differently and to have a daytime party open to all, focused on families with kids. And so we had so many kids on City Hall Plaza painting rocks and getting their faces painted and dancing, and then an evening party as well that was just So fun. No speaking program, just dancing.
What was your favorite part?
Getting to see all of Boston represented in that tent on City Hall Plaza. People sometimes say we're a city that doesn't know how to have fun or you're too stuffy. But it turns out when you throw a good party and make it open to all, then we have a lot of fun.
So it made us think, too. We put out some the chance for our members of our texting group to ask questions for you that we would bring to you. And it made us think of the Open Streets Initiative, where we had a question from Claire of Dorchester. So Claire texted, "I'm loving the open streets and street festivals. Can we expect more through the fall and next year? Are there thoughts of permanent street closures to change to pedestrian only?"
It is sometimes we forget how much potential is there in the public space that we use, because it's often just routinely used for other things like car traffic or parking cars. And when we opened up Center Street on JP to all, just as the city's seen with Newbury Street and other places or in front of the Copley Library about a month ago, it basically turns the street into a park and everyone comes out. We had a very successful Little Saigon night market as well in Dorchester a couple weekends ago. We are planning two other major open streets events this month on Blue Hill Ave, and then next month in Dorchester, running the length of Dorchester Ave. And so we'll have those two large-scale events. Newbury Street is also back open. We wanted to really make sure it was not just on Newbury, but out in the neighborhoods as well. And we're learning from each one of these. The goal is to see what works, see what doesn't work, both in terms of the infrastructure and street closures and the logistics of it, but also the community programming and partnerships and groups that come out. And as we fine-tune that, we'll be able to hopefully do more of it and in more places and with more frequency as well.
So we're here with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu on Mondays with the Mayor. Listeners can join our texting group by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. And it turned out what our listeners most wanted to talk about was the T. So here is Abby of Dorchester Center, and here's what she had to say.
How can the city push forward infrastructure improvements and reassure riders that the T is safe? My husband and I take the Red Line to work every morning, and we often don't feel it's a safe and reliable way for us to get to and from home and work each day. There have been mechanical issues, a ton of delays, and with things like the fire on the Orange Line, we are often not reassured. It also seems like the T has been neglected because the majority of white-collar workers can now work from home. There are hundreds of people that still rely on the T every day, including frontline workers, first responders, and anyone who can't work out of the home, and it doesn't feel like the T issues are being prioritized.
So you nodded a lot during that cut. How often are you hearing comments just like that one? And do you feel like you have leverage you need with the T?
Well, I was nodding viciously at the part about the T being neglected, because it has been, but it's not just during the pandemic. In fact, we are where we are because we have an aging system. Many of the train cars decades past their useful life, the tracks needing to be replaced, technology very, very out of date. And we are now seeing that funding, which didn't get put in along the way to upgrade, improve, maintain, is now all coming due in a huge bill right now that is not just costs, but safety issues and credibility for the entire system. The state legislature, both the House and the Senate, has voted through a provision that would change the governance structure of the MBTA board to add two seats, one for the mayor of Boston to delegate to someone, and one for another MBTA community to have a direct voice as well. This would be hugely impactful, and we're waiting for to see if the governor will sign that or send
it back. Is it necessary? Having that level of representation, is it necessary for you to have the leverage you need? I mean, you've been very clear in public comments, especially recently, about sort of the size of the Boston ridership and the fact that the team needs to be responsive to Boston needs.
This is not only do we make up the largest part of the T's service area, the T is in some ways the foundation for everything that our city is trying to do as well. All of the workers that were mentioned, the frontline workers, hospital workers, families who have no other alternative except riding the T, every bit that gets delayed or or put on the shoulders of our residents ends up getting paid for by the city at large anyway. And so it's really past time. I mean, we've seen such frequency of incidents now. We can no longer tolerate tinkering around the edges or just trying to fix things up here or there. We need large-scale track maintenance and signal upgrades just on the Orange Line alone. That is probably, I'm hearing, the most urgent of the needs. And we saw the Orange Line train just the other day on that bridge.
It is time on fire.
It is time to talk about just ripping the Band-Aid off and taking drastic action. If we need to have a larger scale shutdown.
What's drastic action?
Rather than just trying to do a little bit of track here or there every weekend or late at night, actually doing it all in one sweep, getting it done, would then free up resources at the T to focus on improving other parts of it. And I know the train cars are on order and they're coming, but it all comes back down to the infrastructure. And as long as that track still is questionable in terms of how old it is, and as long as those signals still require extra staffing power because they're not the most updated digital types of signals, we are going to be held back. So the city of Boston,
shut it down in big chunks and just shut it down, fix it is what
you're
saying.
I know that's painful because it would be tremendously disruptive. But we are at that point where prolonging this will make it worse and continue to bring about safety issues. Plus, the city of Boston can play a big role in trying to ensure that there are reasonable alternatives. We could give over street space for shuttle buses as alternatives to go as quickly as possible. And we will do everything we can to work hand in hand with the T. It's time to think at that scale of large scale, disruptive, but necessary intervention.
Have you expressed this to the MBTA?
I have.
All right. So I'm going to shift us now because, again, this is the theme of today is so much to cover. All right. So I'm going to go back to a member of our texting group. This is Stella of Canton, who texted about COVID. And the message reads in part, I am truly astounded when people are surprised at COVID cases rising. We still get a flu shot every year for the Spanish flu. Can we please set realistic expectations with regards to the fact that we will continuously have more strains with an ebb and flow? You set up a set of benchmarks back in February, you know, tracking things like, I had the list and I lost it in my
rates and ICU capacity and community transmission.
Thank you. And are you still using those benchmarks and are we in the red on any of them?
So watching our hospital capacity is still very, very important. And in fact, we are doing quite well there as new treatments for COVID have become much more readily available and vaccination rates have meant that in Massachusetts, you know, we're still trying to close gaps, but it has meant that the most severe cases are being avoided because of vaccination, even if there's sort of reinfection happening. The community transmission rate and the testing rate is something that we might look to less, not because it's unimportant, but because as fewer people are accessing testing, the numbers get skewed a little bit.
Especially if they're testing at home. Instead.
Exactly, and not reporting it through the formal testing sites. So actually, in some ways, the best leading indicator is wastewater levels. Everybody uses the bathroom and it all goes into the system and that's being measured. And so we've been able to very accurately look ahead to see when levels in the water are rising. And then that coincides with infection rates as well.
So your dashboard has essentially changed with the time over the last 6 months, and where wastewater levels wasn't on it in February, it's a big factor of what you're watching now.
We have now gotten more evidence to just check every time the wastewater peaks. Is there a peak that follows? And it's been remarkably accurate.
And do you have triggers set in place where you might make changes to city policy around vaccinations, indoor masking, et cetera? Do you have thresholds that you have set for yourself?
We're following closely what the CDC is doing. And the CDC now has a kind of red, yellow, green metric by county, although we know that Boston's numbers are often more concentrated and disproportionately higher even within the Suffolk County numbers. I think I am coordinating most closely with the Boston Public Health Commission and BPS as we're thinking about heading into next school year, especially as the weather grows colder and people will be going indoors more. Another big factor that has changed even very recently is the availability of vaccinations for kids under 5. And so that will be a huge game changer as well as we think about policies and continue to coordinate with the CDC on what we'll do.
And are you prepared if metrics go into the red and the CDC declares the red to reinstate some of the pandemic prevention measures you've done in the past and loosened?
We need to have, so getting back to the questioner's frame, this is something that we're going to be living with for the foreseeable future. And so we need to have policies that take into account that rapid response or even better, proactive anticipation of when peaks and surges will happen and being responsive to the specific conditions, even classroom by classroom. So I imagine, you know, what we already moved to towards the end of this last school year was a policy where the blanket requirement was lifted at the very, very end of the school year, but there are still specific requirements where if there is a case that is a positive test result or a cluster in a classroom, then masking would be required for a short period of time. If there is a time where we see just a citywide surge, we could likely require masking for a short period of time. So being able to be flexible and targeted with our protections, I think, is how we adapt to this in the long run.
All right. So being aware of your time and how much time we have left with you, I'm going to flag that there will be listeners who will say, you didn't talk about the police commissioner, you didn't talk about the superintendent. I'm going to hold those, especially schools. We'll have you back in August. We'll talk schools in August, and I want to flag that now. But there are a couple of things in the short term. I'm going to play a little bit of sound for you this month. This is LeBron James, the basketball star who's also partial owner of the Boston Red Sox.
Why do you hate Boston?
Because they're racist as f***. That's why. They will say anything, and it's fine. I mean, my life. I mean, she's been dealing with it my whole life. I don't mind it. Like, I hear it. Like, if I hear somebody, like, close by, I check them real quick. I move on to the game. Whatever the f***. They're going to say whatever the f*** they want to say. They might throw something on you. I mean, I got a beer thrown on me leaving the game.
You know that there's a lot of concern and a lot of national expression, especially during the last Celtics playoff round, about racism in Boston sports fans. I just want to give you a chance to react.
Yeah, and I don't want to downplay the experience, particularly of players who have lifted up this concern, especially those who have been in the game for a long time and have had exposure in Boston in years past. Boston has had that reputation nationally, and it is something that we have to confront and address. We are also a city that is very dedicated to eradicating racism in every space. I am proud to be a Celtics fan, and I will be up there in the balcony cheering my heart out, and it gets intense up there.
Do you ever hear racism when you're in the stands?
I have not heard specific racist chants, but we do get a little edgy in Boston, right? We do use words that I would not use, that I would not want my kids to use in chanting at games. And that in some ways is part of we are hardcore fans here in Boston. I would be happy to take LeBron around and show him the Boston that I know, that I love, and that we are building here to really make sure that everyone is included in our city.
Okay, LeBron James, there you go. Mayor Wu is inviting you to take a walk around with her. All right, but there's the other side of this bookend too, and this is David Ortiz in the Seaport. You're going to see him this afternoon. This is David Ortiz in Cooperstown yesterday, talking a little bit about Boston.
When I think about Boston, I also think about the last game I played, standing on that field at Fenway Park. It feels like the whole city of New England and each one and every one of you was surrounding me and was showing me all your love. I will always be Boston, and I will always be there for you, Boston. I love you, Boston.
A true Boston baseball legend. I think about my fandom with the Sox and how many of those moments are David Ortiz moments. You're going to be with him this afternoon. An easy player to love. What's going to be in your heart and what are you most excited about when you see him this afternoon?
I mean, again, it's just, as you said, a different side of showcasing how intense Boston fans are. We are loyal. We are with you. And for me, it brings special meaning because, in fact, I came to Boston for college didn't know anyone here at all. And that was the season that Big Papi and others broke the curse. And so it was a very, very auspicious and welcoming start to my time here, and have been proud to see him a little bit over the years, and can't wait to welcome him home.
What are you going to say to him?
I don't know yet. I don't know if I'll be able to speak. I don't know if you have the capacity to have words come out of my mouth.
All right. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, thank you so much for joining us today on Mondays with the Mayor here on Radio Boston. We will see you again next month.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Like other neighboring cities, Boston says it's seen an uptick in 311 complaints about rodents during the pandemic, with so many people home.
That's NBC10's Mike Manzoni this past April on Boston's rat problem. But is the rat population on the rise, or are we just noticing them more? Certainly people are noticing the rats. Joining us now, John Ulrich. He is the Assistant Commissioner of Environmental Services for the Department of Inspectional Services for the City of Boston. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you're a guy where rats are in your portfolio.
Yes.
So what does that mean?
So I run the Environmental Service Division of Inspectional Services for the City of Boston. And our main function is rodent control in the city. We do that. We have 14 licensed pest control inspectors spread out through wards. And we respond to 311 complaints. We have proactive soil baiting. We do pest control on city property and public property, parks, stuff like that.
So have you noticed an uptick in 311 calls?
I would say that this year is average. 2020, there was a bit of an uptick. It went down in 2021, but not by much. I wouldn't say that there is an overwhelming number of more calls.
So that's the count on the calls. Tell us a little bit about how you count the rats. I mean, you can't do a rat census. You can't find them all. So how do you figure out how many rats you're dealing with and where they are?
So that is a challenge. It's a challenge nationwide. How do you find the population? There is no good measure. It's we respond to complaints. We do proactive inspections. We do about maybe two neighborhood walkthroughs a week in coordination with other departments. We get referrals from other departments. Public Works, we work very closely with. Constituent Services, NRISD, and the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services.
I'm sorry, what is NRISD?
Constituent Service. We have a department, a division of ISD that is Constituent Services that deal directly with constituents in the neighborhoods.
And I'm very curious about these walkthroughs. What, literally, tell me what that is.
So we set up a meeting with constituents, sometimes neighborhood groups, neighborhood associations. We coordinate them through the Office of Neighborhood Services, the Mayor's Office, and our constituents. And we have our whole team go out, myself or Director Mike Mackin, and multiple inspectors. And we walk the neighborhood where we see an increase of rodent activity.
For example, one of the most recent neighborhoods you've walked?
East Boston.
Okay.
East Boston, Jeffries Point, seen an increase. And so we allow the residents to point to what they're seeing. We do education. The biggest part of walkthroughs is education. So we teach people about the causes of rodent activity, supporting environments that help rodents thrive, which is trash, harborage, and water.
Yeah, what do you want people to know?
That the main way to address rodent activity is to make sure your trash is stored properly, that you clean up after your pets. That's one that many people don't know, but dog feces and pet feces is a food source for rodents. Feeding the birds or bird seed, bird feeders, is another large food source in the city. And so we have to pay attention to those. And if we take care of those, if you see rodents on your property, you should immediately call a pest control company, a technician, licensed pest control. Call us, call 311. When you put in a complaint to 311, it will go directly to the area inspector. And if you include your contact information, that inspector will reach out to you immediately, within 24 to 48 hours.
All right. And just lastly, your preferred method of rat control? I mean, besides the mitigation things you're talking about, but
So our approach is an IPM approach. So we put in controls to remove the supportive environment. And then the last part of that is introducing pesticides or some kind of pest control. But before that, you want to cover your trash. You want to remove things that supported any kind of harborage. And then the last part of that would be hiring a pest control company.
All right. John Ulrich is the Assistant Commissioner for Environmental Services in Boston's Department of Inspectional Services. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So listening into that conversation was WBUR's Walter Wuthman. He has recently done some reporting on rats and solutions for curbing their numbers. Welcome back, Walt.
Hey, Tiziana.
So first, reactions to what we just learned from John Ulrich.
Yeah, I mean, the city does a lot. The city does a lot in terms of pest control, especially in a city like Boston, where I think a lot of us are used to seeing rats quite often. I sort of got into this story a couple of years ago. You may remember on Radio Boston, we were seeing all these headlines, you know, anecdotally, people seeing more rats around their homes.
In 2020, during the early stages of the pandemic.
During the early stages of the pandemic, we brought on former Assistant Commissioner Boucher to talk about it. I went back and listened to that interview, and there was just such a great quote. I pulled it, and I want to play it again here today.
All the rats need are food and water. They don't need anything extravagant. It doesn't have to be spring water, and it doesn't have to be filet mignon. you know, any type of food refuse, any type of water, puddles, stagnant water, things of that nature will suffice as a food source.
You can hear Chris Siderick laughing during that quote, but it shows the point that rats are really resilient. They can survive on a lot. 2 years later, I wanted to see, you know, were these anecdotal? Was this a flash in the pan, or is it a real thing? And it does turn out to be, there does seem to be a real change.
So you did a numbers hustle on this. You did some counting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I got help from Todd Wallach, an editor here who's amazing with data. We pulled all the 311 complaints from 2013. We filtered for rat and rodent complaints, and we do see that complaints are up 48% from 2019 to 2021, the last year of full data. So people are seeing rats more. People are reporting rats more. To dig a little further into it, I got in touch with an urban ecologist at Fordham University who's done a study specific to New York City, but he's been looking at cities all across the Northeast. And he did confirm that at least in the Northeast and in some Midwestern cities, it seems that the pandemic almost certainly led to an increase in urban rat populations.
All right. So we do think that there is a smoke and fire correlation here.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So one of the things that is interesting in your reporting is how cities and towns are combating this problem. I mean, I think everybody just assumes that the answer is those big black boxes, right, that you see sitting around. But that's not necessarily the case.
No, and like the assistant commissioner just said, you know, trapping is kind of like the last resort. The most important thing is eliminating shelter, burrows, water, food. But when it does come to trapping and killing rats, different communities are doing some pretty creative things. So I followed a team around Somerville. They have about 50 of these metal boxes they called smart boxes, which rats crawl into, and they kill them with a quick electric shock.
Because is it considered humane?
More humane than poison.
Okay. Sorry, finish the description.
It's debatable. Yeah. And because they're electric, they also record every kill, and they send an email to this portal, which the city can then use to see what time was the rat killed, where was the rat killed, and they can construct these data maps, actually, of where the most rats are and when they're most active. I went out with one of the teams in Boston, on Boston Common, where they are fumigating rat burrows with carbon monoxide, this machine called the Burrow RX. It's this hose that they put down into the burrows and fill with this carbon monoxide gas. And they try to eliminate whole burrow systems with that. You know, it's kind of dramatic. You see the smoke rising out of these holes. And then as the smoke rises, they're filling them with dirt to try to close off the whole system. And that seems to be a quite effective way to control the rat population.
And let's talk about the humaneness of that particular approach.
Yeah, so I really was wondering, are these, you know, things humane? You know, rats are obviously a public health problem, but they're also intelligent animals with complex social worlds that I think we should be concerned about, you know, how we treat them. So I got in touch with an animal rights activist named Holly Elmore. She works at the think tank called Rethinking Priorities, and she ranked all of these things with all the existing research that she could find. And she does rank the carbon monoxide as quite humane comparatively. It probably makes the rats lose consciousness, like they're falling asleep. The shocking is probably humane as long as it's effective the first time. She says the worst thing you can do is feed the rats poison. Most commercial rat poisons affect the rat's bloodstream. And she gave me this pretty shocking description of what happens to the rat's blood when they consume the poison.
They have hemorrhages that can affect, you know, their brain. It can be really painful, especially if there's hemorrhages in the abdomen. And it's just a bad death.
Ew.
Yeah, and what's really bad too is when, you know, hawks, owls, eagles eat contaminated rats, and they've been known to die. Children can get into rat poison, and the EPA estimates 10,000 children across the country are sickened every year, not die, but, you know, are sickened and have to get treatment. So there is sort of a growing movement to, if not eliminate, you know, really cut back on the use of commercial rat poisons.
So I know you, and I know, or my impression is, Walt, and we're talking to Walt Wuthman from WBUR here about rat reporting. It seems to me there's always something you find to fall in love with in a story that you do. So we're doing rats. So what did you fall in love with in this story?
I learned so much about rats that I never knew. One of the more interesting things is that there's different species, different types of rats, and we have different rats than like San Francisco. So Boston, we have more of the brown rat or the Norway rat or the sewer rat. They live closer to the ground and we see them more often. Whereas on the West Coast and in places like Tokyo, they have roof rats.
Roof rats.
You know, which interact a little bit less with our garbage. And, you know, those cities have actually seen less upticks in complaints. And so they think, you know, they actually responded to lockdowns differently. But they're two different kinds of rats. Rats also have really hard teeth. Sometimes they're rated harder than copper or iron, and that's why they can chew through those really thick trash cans. Their teeth grow throughout their whole life, so they have to keep gnawing them down. That sort of blew my mind as well.
Yeah, so it may not be fair to say that you fall in love with something, but something's fascinating. It's the physiology of these rats in this case.
Yeah, they're interesting, and they're clearly really smart. And then another thing I didn't include in the reporting, but just going through the 311, there's just some hilarious and disturbing complaints. And so I would encourage anyone to go to Boston's 311 website and read through some of those rodent complaints.
All right, WBUR's Walter Wuthman, thanks so much for joining us for our From the Newsroom.
Thank you.